the majority of the workforce in CVP, I think, is under 35 years of age. They're just starting their career. They didn't come up the same way you and I did. They came up the way they came up. That's them, right? We should not have them change to the way we view things. The organization needs to adapt to more the way they look things, right? Not, and I'm not saying one or the other, but move the needle that way. When you go to an academy class, and I'll speak for OFO, my basic academy class looked one way back in 1989. The academy classes now are made up of people that were not in my class. There are people in the classes now that were never considered a career 30 years ago in customs. And now you go in there, you got people from all over the country, all levels of education, all levels of background, all different kinds of people. Those are the people that we needed to, I felt that I needed to speak for, because of the 62,000, there's only 6, 7, 8 people in that room that will ultimately make the decision. I mean, the decision comes down to just a couple of people, but they don't have a voice in that room. I felt I needed to be the voice.
Welcome to CT Strategies Unpacked, a podcast that explores insider perspectives of global trade, customs, and border management. In this leadership series, we talk to current and former trade professionals to get a layer deeper than regulation and enforcement. In today's episode, we're talking to Bill Ferrara, founder of Harbor Island Consulting. Bill shares his thoughts on successful leadership and the outlook for growth in the law enforcement environment. We'll get a peek into his journey through CBP and firsthand insight into the organization's past, present, and future. Recorded live on September 6th, 2022, this is the 7th podcast in the CTS Meet the Team series.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us for our latest segment of CTS Unpacked. Today we have a special guest with us, Bill Ferrara. Bill Ferrara had a long and illustrious career with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also a good friend of mine that we'll talk about some of our adventures and experiences we had while working together in Customs and Border Protection. So Bill, thanks for joining us today. I know we've been chasing you down for about 2 months now, trying to get you on the screen. Happy that you were able to join us. So welcome to CTS Unpacked. We this is an opportunity we take to introduce the affiliates from CT Strategies to the public. And once we learned that you had joined CT Strategies, we immediately put you on the list to get you into this podcast series. So just to get right into it, I know you in the spirit of transparency. You know, you and I have gone back a few years. But for our listeners, tell us about yourself and tell us how you ended up in Legacy Customs and obviously Customs and Border Protection.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you, Eric. Good to see you here, and thanks for the invitation. And it has been a few months to pin down a time and a date that worked for us, but I've been busy retiring in retirement, so enjoying myself. So, but again, thanks for having me on today and offering me the opportunity to catch up with an old friend. And so, to answer your question, I started in customs. How I got involved in customs is, when I was in college, I took a job in a trucking warehouse, unloading trucks and sweeping the floor, and really just any part-time job, as we all did in trying to pay our way through college. And the company that I happened to work for was a customs house broker. So customs inspectors would come in and examine the inbound freight. And one of them befriended me and talked to me and told me what an exciting career he had had. And he was also from Rhode Island, where I grew up and where I was working at the time. And he talked about different adventures he had, working overseas, training overseas, working in different parts of the country. And I thought it was really exciting. So I threw my hat in the ring and got offered a job in Calexico. This was
garden spot.
Exactly, the garden spot of the organization. And There was no internet at the time. So you looked at the Rand McNally map and noticed it was just a smidge away from San Diego.
Right there. It's like,
it was right there. And I said, sure, I'd go. And so the adventure began. And it was a great adventure. And it started in Calexico. And I still have dear friends of mine to this day that, I know I keep in touch with Pete Flores. Being one of them, who's currently the EAC and took over for me. Pete was one of the first people that I met walking through the door, and he and his family and I have been friends since then. And quite frankly, it was probably not the place I would have picked knowing what I know now, but I am so thrilled that I started there.
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, I can totally sympathize with that. Similar scenario for me. I recruited by a recruiter at college when I was in El Paso going to college. And I thought I was going to go to San Diego. I thought I was going to go to wherever, because that's what at the time everybody was being sent to San Diego. So when I got my FedEx packet and said, congratulations, we're sending you to Douglas, Arizona. So I did the exact same thing, opened up the map, and where's Douglas, Arizona? Looking for Arizona. I see Tucson. And then the fine print down below, it's like 2 inches away. I see Douglas. Well, it's not that far from Tucson. How bad could it be? But I actually did some time in Calexico as well.
That's right.
My son was born there. And it was the same scenario. I didn't know that I would end up passing through either Douglas or Calexico. But I don't know that I would take that off the resume. And looking back on it, would you feel like that was something that a good learning opportunity for you?
Oh, 100%. And when I tell people and share with people, especially newer officers that are in places that perhaps they didn't either want to be or expected to be or plan to be, I share with them that Calexico was my master's degree at the time, customs. You learn more in a place like Calexico than you will in many other places. And some of the finest of the officers were there. I learned from Rudy Maeda, Myrna Rodriguez, Carlos Silva. These are folks that are institutions in our organization in CBP. Where they taught you so much just by watching and just by them sharing little tidbits that you can't get that at an academy, frankly. And I think the world of our academy or in other locations. So no, I wouldn't have picked it. I'm glad it was picked for me. And that was kind of synonymous with my entire career. Never really picked where I wanted to go or what I wanted to do. My career kind of picked me and told me where to go. And really it started in Calexico, what a completely foreign place to me. I mean, I got there and January 3rd was my EOD. I showed up. I was walking to the port of entry with a short sleeve shirt on and slacks. And the folks that were leaving the port of entry had winter hats, coats, jackets, scarves, gloves, bundled up, and I was very comfortable. And I said, well, if I'm comfortable in January and these folks are cold, come August, the tables will be turned. And unfortunately, I was correct. I've never experienced heat and dryness like that. But again, all just great building blocks for a career that went by in a flash, but had a great time the 33 years.
So just for the sake of our viewers and listeners, what's the temperature today in Rhode Island?
Temperature today is 63 degrees and sunny.
So I received a text from a friend of mine in El Centro yesterday, and yesterday it was 114.
Right, there you go.
And just for the sake, just for the our folks that have never passed through the Imperial Valley or that part of southern the United States, and that's. When you said January, I'm like, wow, that's like prime time. That's like the best climate is when it's probably beautiful. 78 degrees, 80 degrees for a few months. And it's perfect golfing weather, perfect, outdoorsy weather. But then once March, April hits, it gets into the hundreds and it stays until the hundreds well into October. I remember my sons, when I was there, I had my youngest was born there. And so when they were little, little babies, 2, 3 years old, I took them trick or treating on October 31st, right. And they were being drenched because it was so hot. It was so hot. I would get in my vehicle in the morning, and I had to, my shift started at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'd be getting into my vehicle at 5:30, 5:45. And when I turned the vehicle on, it was already like 98 degrees. And it's literally 9 or 6 o'clock in the morning, and it's still dark outside, and it's still almost 100 degrees. So it's one of those places that you grow to love it, you grow to appreciate it, but it is quite the challenge when it comes to just managing the heat, especially for someone like yourself that coming from the East Coast. So you gave me a good segue, and I'm familiar with your career path, but for the sake of our listeners, just walk us through for a second how you started in Calexico and the path you took to get where you ended up.
Yeah, and I'd love to, but again, I get this question a lot, especially when I was speaking with the academy classes. I never had a career plan. My career planned me. And we're friends, and I know you're in the same boat as I am. Had it not been for our wives and our families, none of it would have been even remotely possible or remotely fun, right? So Calexico, I got married to my wife, Michelle, in September after being in Calexico a year and a half. She was back east. So then she moved out, and immediately we got transferred to Calais, Maine. So I went in January from late December from Calais, Maine, I'm sorry, from Calexico, California to Calais, Maine. I could not go any further in the continental United States than that. And we talk about shifts in temperature. I remember leaving Calexico, it was 86 degrees. I got to Calais, it was -4. So both me and my car and my wife, it took a little while to adjust to that. As you said, your car was 100 degrees when you get in the morning. My battery said, no, I am not starting in this. So learned that lesson about cold cranking amps. But went to Calexico, I went to Calais, spent 5 great years there. Again, the northern border is one of those areas that are underappreciated, in my opinion. The amount of work that the men and women of CBP do on the northern border is incredibly important to national security, to economic security, and really the heartbeat and the heartbeat of the local communities. The communities up there are much smaller, and typically, other than of course the Buffaloes and some of the larger ones, but the majority of the northern border is made up of small towns, and it's truly the heartbeat of the town. You are part of the fabric of the town, and you learn that, and that's where I first learned the community and what customs did and now CBP does to help the community grow, help the community prosper, help the community be safe. Because in some of the locations in Calais, some of our subports, the ports of entry acted as 911, because there was no 911. They acted as when there was a fire or medical emergency, they would call the port because they knew someone would be there. So that was a tremendous experience. Our oldest son was born in Calais, 5 years there, then a short stint down in Connecticut. I worked in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Because at the time we thought it would be great to get closer to home. And then we went to Connecticut, and the work wasn't exactly robust. And I learned then for the first time that I needed to be busy, I needed to work, I needed to have some challenges. And then to my point about the support of my wife and my family, but in this particular case, my wife. So I had applied at the same time for Bridgeport. I had applied for Bermuda preclearance because we thought it would be great to live on an island, and it would, you know, Bermuda's an awesome place. So I got a call about 3 months into being in Bridgeport, and things happen for a reason. That's another thing I truly believe in. And I'm sitting there saying, I cannot do this for the rest of my life. I cannot work in Bridgeport, where work started on Monday morning at 8 o'clock and pretty much ended on Tuesday at 11 o'clock. So I'm like, I have to find something else. And the telephone rings back in the day when you get job offers over the phone, not in an email, and said, hey, would you like to go to Bermuda? We have an opening and we'd like you to go. So I called Michelle and she was home with our son, and we just had moved into the house, and she was packing boxes. And I called her, I said, hey, would you what do you think about going to Bermuda? And she says, for a vacation or to move? And I said, to move. She says, okay, I'll stop packing the boxes now. So, I mean, that's a, you know, a tremendous example of the support, right? Because we had, you know, we had talked about Bermuda before, we had talked about these things, but calling her where I think most people would say, no, hey, we just moved into this house, we're just getting settled. She's like, it's an adventure, let's go. And we did. And so we went to Bermuda and had 4 great years in Bermuda, brought home a souvenir, and that was my youngest son, who was born in Bermuda. It was a great time at the time in Bermuda, great crew. I think it was one of those times in my career where a lot of things started to form, because realizing that, yeah, work's important, but the family piece became more important. It was our son Bill was a year old when we went there, and that balance, kind of that balance, how work nourishes your home and your home nourishes work, and it's really a great balance. And met a lifelong friend, considered a brother there, Russ Labello, chief retired out of Newark, who helped me learn that, helped me, you know, learn to you know, you're going to work hard, but you gotta balance things. And from there, I went to DC for the first time, and went to DC by accident, because at the time when your return rights, it was back to the old districts, which were like the new, with the new field offices, and they put you where they wanted you. And the old region that I came out of, region one, they frowned upon you leaving. So when you came back, they did not give you the garden spots. They were going to send us to a one-person station in the western part of Maine where you lived at the port. And I thought, that's not really good for my family and I right now. So a friend of mine was at headquarters. He said, hey, this opening up this sit room, you can work nights, because, you know, Michelle was a teacher. We had to balance the kids, the daycare and all that. So I threw my hat in the ring and got hired. And lo and behold, I wasn't there very long. And then we had the attacks of 9/11. And again, that was a tremendous, I think in all of us, Eric, and we've had this conversation, you know, indelible mark was put on you as a human being, but certainly in our careers and how the focus became for when it was customs. It really was, it was revenue, it was money and dope. Those are the things that you looked for to like, oh no, this is different. We need to make this shift to anti-terrorism. And I happened to be working in the sit room, which was a part of then Inspection and Control, which is now OFO, the anti-smuggling division, who was responsible for a lot of the initiatives, including CTPAT. So I, with other names that you know well, Mr. Algina, Mr. Bob Perez, Mr. Rich DiNucci, Mr. Ed Moriarty, who's still working for CBP, were tasked to create this program in which the government would partner with industry to help secure the supply chain, because it was evident that government alone, industry alone could not do that, but together we could do better. So that was another turning point. You know, the deaths of all those folks, obviously the attacks, but with me, it was another turning point with respect to working with industry and dropping that adversarial, which was pretty typical with customs, that adversarial relationship and more collaboration. And I don't think there's a bigger collaborator than Mr. Gina and Mr. Perez, two folks that really understood it and drove it. So I had the honor and the opportunity to work with the folks that I mentioned there. Once the program went off the ground, I decided I needed to be a first-line supervisor, because I also thought it was important for me never to chase grade, but to learn each rung of the ladder. So I had an opportunity to become a first-line supervisor up in Ottawa, Canada, and pre-clearance. So that was another eye-opener for me, going there, understanding that being a first-line supervisor is a lot different than being a journeyman, with respect to managing people, managing yourself, and truly learning about yourself. So I was in Ottawa for several years. Great experience, moved down to the mighty port of Worcester, Massachusetts. It's a small two-person port, that does a tremendous amount of cargo, because I felt I needed to learn cargo. So I went there, worked there for a couple of years, and then went over to Boston as the assistant airport director for tactical. And by me taking that job, that was the critical turning point of my entire career at that point. Because I went there, I was on the job just a short period of time, several weeks. And the port director was no longer able to become the port director. It was a non-planned event. She was out of the picture. There were two other assistant port directors, area port directors, and myself being the third. And I was appointed the acting area port director. And it was only supposed to be for 30 days. And full disclosure, total transparency, the reason why I was picked because I was a neutral entity. The director of field operation did not trust, like, whatever you want to call it, the other two area port directors, assistant area port directors. So by default, it became me. I was ill-prepared, ill-equipped, unwilling, all of the things you do not want to have in a leader, I was it. But it was only going to be for 30 days, and then 22 months later, it ended. So from November of 2008 to May of 2014, I was in acting roles, never in my own role. So I was in Boston. I was working multitude of positions. I was my position and the other two I was acting in. And then that's when you and I met. When I applied then, because I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to learn to do this better than I'm doing it now, and applied for the CVPLI program for a couple of reasons. One, to get smarter, but two, it allowed me an exit visa. It allowed me an opportunity to get promoted directly out of where I was, because it wasn't working so well. At the end, there were a lot of things that I couldn't control, and a lot of things I couldn't manipulate because of the totality of the circumstances. But went to CVPLI, met you, met a lot of the most senior leaders now in CBP or recently retired. It really was, I'm going to say it here, the best class that they ever put through CVPLI, but I'm extremely biased.
I can say with all subjectivity that was the best class.
It was, absolutely. And then, you know, then I took a job down at headquarters in a position that I would have never, ever taken. But because of CBPLI, as you know, the capstone was to put you in an unfamiliar location, an unfamiliar position, unfamiliar work, to stretch you and for you to be tested with your education, your knowledge that you learned on your while we were in Chicago together at Booth. So I was put into mission support, of all things, and I went in kicking and screaming. I did not want to do it. And I was an experiment. I didn't know that I was the experiment. I was told later that I was an experiment. They wanted to take a field person and put them in the mission support role. Secret Service did it. They did it successfully. And Mr. Dave Morrell was the executive director of mission support for OFO, was a retired Secret Service agent. And he was the one that pushed it with Mr. Winkowski. And I happened to be the guinea pig, and went in and really learned so much and worked with so many great people that I say that's one of the pivotal pieces that helped prepare me to become later on the EAC of both OS and OFO, and some of my executive director roles, because you had to, that is at those levels, as you know, Eric, as well as I do, you can have the greatest ideas in the world, you can have the greatest vision in the world. If you do not have the money, if you do not have the people, that's all they are great ideas, you get nothing. So I understand and learn that's the budget system, the payrolls, hiring system, the HR system, pretty well to later on, it would help me in my career. So at headquarters of that, I was the director of logistics, then became the deputy executive director of mission support, then the acting director of executive director of mission support, then the Deputy Executive Director for PPA&E, and then the XD of APP at headquarters with a stint as the acting DFO in Chicago in between. And then I was fortunate enough and blessed enough to then become the DFO permanently in an SES in Chicago as the DFO after about 3.5 years in DC. Went out there and really thoroughly enjoyed it. Obviously, we had familiarity. We went to school there. Great team, did some tremendous, tremendous, tremendous counterterrorism work, some work that's still being done today on a grander scale, but really at the baseline of a lot of things that are done throughout the organization. It was happy and was going to retire out of Chicago. And 18 months later, I got a call asking me to go to Boston. And you would think that it's home, I'd like to go, but I was having a good time in Chicago. Michelle loved it there. I loved it there. And I knew what the headaches that I left in Boston were when I left, and I didn't really want to go back to them. And then I came home and my wife said, are you kidding me? We're going to Boston. I said, yes, that was the answer I should have given from the beginning. So we went. And then that 5 years that I spent in Boston as the DFO were probably some of the most rewarding years that I had in the organization, because all of those wrongs that I felt were wrongs, we were able to right. All of the people that were marginalized because of a system in which you were judged on whether I liked you or not, whether I think you were value or not, now I could throw those out the window and say, okay, this is going to be merit-based. This is going to be based on the information below the name and address on a resume. It's going to be, what have you done? What can you do? And are you a good person and a good team player? Will you build? Will you work with the person to the right of you and to the left of you, regardless whether you like them or not? And so that actually took hold. And that was really an exciting time in which I thought I was going to retire from then. And then I got the telephone call after coming back from a TDY that I didn't ask for in London as the acting DHS attaché. Again, another opportunity that I didn't want. But I said, hey, I'll go do it. It'll be something. And it was really a good opportunity. But I came home and the phone rang. Would you like to come to DC as the EAC for OS? And I said, no. And I kept saying no. And then they said, no, you don't understand.
Not really a question.
It's not really a question.
I know it's not really a question.
And things happen for a reason. So I said yes, and I went down. And that's, of course, where you and I get an opportunity to work again together. And boy, I was glad we were on the same team down there, because almost immediately after being there, 6 months after being there, the pandemic struck. And OS, our shop, we were the tip of the spear for the response for CBP. And that coordination, and it just again was one of those places I did not want to be. I didn't ask to be, really, but I'm glad I was there, because I was part of something that was much bigger than something that I could have done myself. Just the way, you know, you were a leader. You're always a leader, but it's particularly in this case a leader in working from home, which was a complete foreign concept until then, right? What we needed to do for the workforce, and how we went about making sure people were just simply okay, and really, we did I think a pretty good job based on the circumstances, you know, based on a small group of folks doing a really good job to try to make everybody okay. Not great, not good, because the world was in a place that we hadn't seen in 100 years, and none of us have seen in our lifetime. So it consumed about a year of my life. It was the hardest work that I've ever done. It was a total team effort, but Vernon Ferrey at the time was the executive director for operation support. I'm sorry, for ops for OFO, was an incredible partner in us trying to get things done, and with the White House, with the department, the vaccine effort that didn't happen, that should have happened, that we battled and found other ways to do it. But really, too many lives were lost, too many people were sick, But I think we did the best that we could based on it. And it was because of team. It was because a lot of people checked their egos at the door and just rolled up their sleeves. And then Figure and I, things started to calm down, and it would be great that I'd retire out of OS, which was my, at that point, my goal there. I went down, I pulled everybody 3 years. I am eligible to retire, and I will retire. So just know you're renting me for three and a half years. You're renting me for 3.5 years. I'm gone. And then I got another one of those phone calls saying, hey, would you like to? And they were, I will give them credit at that point. They stopped and they said, no, we're putting you in the position of EAC of OFO. I said, fair enough. When are we going to do it? We're going to announce it tomorrow. I said, fair enough. I said, but I'd like to tell some people, because not only is it a shock to me, but it's going to be a shock to my team, because as you know, you were the AC at the time for international affairs. We had finally kind of recalibrated pandemic wise, and we were moving forward, and we had that offsite, and we had that phone call on that Monday morning. That was a very, the next morning, it was a Wednesday morning, to this day was one of the most difficult phone calls I've ever had, conversations we ever had. It was more difficult because we were working from home, different places, but it was difficult because I had to tell people who I've committed to, who I've told that I were going to do things recently, that, hey, I'm leaving you. With no warning, good luck, because I'm out of here in 3 weeks. But went to OFO, things happen for a reason. Had thrilled to be back in OFO and really started as a GS5 in Calexico with no aspirations to be anything other than a first line inspector in Providence, Rhode Island. And here I am at the end of the day in a position that some larger than life figures have held. And now I'm in that position. So I was humbled, I was terrified. As I am with all new positions, terrified of failing, terrifying of not being able to do the job. And there I ended up, and that's where I retired out of in December. And I just ran through 33 years, and it took probably longer than the people want to listen. But really, the underlying theme throughout was many of the opportunities that I was given, many of the jobs that I were given, I didn't ask for. People asked me to do them. And I would say over half of them, probably three quarters of them, I said, my initial reaction was, no, I don't want to do it. And it wasn't for any other reason. I didn't think I could do it, that I didn't want to fail. I wasn't worthy of some of these positions, you know. And really just that work ethic that I learned from when we were a kid, that drive and understanding that, okay, it's not just you doing these jobs, that you get you got everybody around you. When I left, there were 33,000 people in OFO, you know, that's a lot of people when pulling on the oars in the same direction can move mountains. And they did. And they did that through Operation Allied Welcome. Deputy Sabatino, Diane Sabatino is one of the, you know, one of the most remarkable people that I work with when it comes to crisis management. And boy, that was a crisis. And having the confidence and being comfortable in my own skin to say, she's a lot better at this. Support her. Support the other people. Like, it didn't have to be about me. I always had to be about the mission. And that's something that I learned very early on, really from first days in Calexico, and then reinforced throughout my career.
You know what? I could literally go off on like 20 or 30 different tangents based on the things that you've covered so far. But I do want to get to one thing that I think is important that we talk about. And as you alluded, we were both in the same leadership development class. It was the first one that CBP was doing. It was like a rebranding of a similar class that was done by Legacy Customs years before. And we were in the inaugural class, and no one knew what it was going to be, what you were going to get out of it, whether it was worth the squeeze. I mean, all of us kind of went in there somewhat blind, but I think somewhat aligned in the intent, because there was a lot of us that were at the halfway point of our careers when that class was started. And I remember walking into the room, and to be honest with you, I remember going through the interview process and seeing, yes, a lot of my, you know, colleagues and contemporaries kind of interviewing and then seeing them kind of fall off throughout the filtering process, where they whittled it down from, you know, 1,000 applicants to 50 students in that initial cohort. And it was a mixed bag of offices being represented there for the sake of our listeners and our viewers. You have, you know, representatives from Border Patrol, from Office of Field Operations, Air and Marine Operations, Mission Support, you name it. It was a lot of the different offices were represented. And it was a great experiment for me, and I think for all of us, on just finding a way to have that mutual respect for your colleagues across the organization, because we were, for good reasons and bad, so identifiable by our uniforms and the colors of our uniforms within the organization, that created these barriers for collaboration across the organization. And I think that's what the organization was trying to accomplish, was trying to break some of these things down. And I remember that we had a lot of robust conversations about, the things that we could do to improve the organization. And at the time they were building the curriculum as we were going through the class. And they were taking a lot of these examples from the private sector of, you know, organizations that failed, organizations that succeeded, organizational change, and on all these types of things, strategic leadership, you name it. So many different topics we covered in that course. And I remember that, you know, with all those, there's always these little cliches that come with the module. And one of those was speaking truth to power. And all of us have examples of guys in the back of the room that said, well, if I were in charge, you know, we could do it this way, or we should have done it that way. Or, you know, I don't know who put you in charge. And so very quick to just kind of throw, you know, these bombs from the back of the room, which I don't think is really what was the objective of that module. And so for me, you know, coming up to the ranks and in the organization we were in, you have a lot of very headstrong people. You have a lot of alphas. The higher you get in the organization, the more alphas there are. It's just by the nature of the environment. And so you end up getting into a room with a lot of folks that have got 10, 15, 25, 30 years in the organization that are hardened in their thought process, hardened in their beliefs, you know, very, very determined to stick to the way that they believe in. And so what ends up happening is what we later found out was groupthink. You know, you get these folks in there that no one wants to challenge the theme or the trend of the message. And so everybody just kind of goes along with it, and then policies get it put into place. And then here we are, you know, 20 years later, analyzing the flaws in the policy or the mistakes that were made by that organization or by that leader. And when we were together in Washington, the last few years of our careers, it was a very volatile time in our country. And one of which was just the political volatility that was happening at the time. In that period from 2016 to 2020, there was a lot of things happening in our country. There were riots happening all over the world, all over the country. And then the pandemic on top of it. This is in addition to the things that we did operationally, which we could spend hours talking about, just the routine operations that we undertook while we were there. But these different things that we had never had to deal with before as an organization. And I was fortunate enough to be at least in the room with our senior leadership team for Customs and Border Protection, where we were trying to wrestle with how do we deal with, you know, riots outside our building? How do we deal with, you know, pandemic where we're having to, you know, filter, you know, legitimate travelers that are coming in and out of the country? You know, what's the legal framework that we're going to use? And there's so many different things that we're basically trying to write policy. And I recall vividly. And we get the presidential executive order literally on Friday evening, and then you and your team would spend the entire weekend figuring out, okay, how operationally are we going to, you know, implement this, so that way you get the word out not only to the ports but to the airlines on, hey, these are the rules of the road from now on, and so many of those things. It seemed like it always happened on Friday, but I remember in those conversations, and I was probably the lowest ranking person in the room, and I think from an age standpoint, probably one of the younger guys in the room that wasn't, you know, a staffer. And I recall vividly so many different times of there being something, a challenge put on the table, And then the alphas immediately, you know, flex their muscles and say, we're gonna meet this one head on. And then I could see the room just basically collectively kind of, you know, puff their chests up and say, this is how we're gonna do this. And so many times you were the one person at the end of the table saying, sir, ma'am, if I may. And then you would completely counter everything that was being said in the room. And having known you for a long time, I know that you have a very colorful way of doing things. But you always did this in a very, very diplomatic, pragmatic, logical way. And for me, that was the perfect example of speaking truth to power. So for the sake of our listeners, because that took courage, and I'm not going to lie. It takes courage to be able to be the outlier in a conversation like that one, in a room full of alphas, in an organization like that. What gave you the courage to be able to do something like that?
Well, first of all, thank you for those kind words, especially I consider you the biggest diplomat that I know. To say that I was used diplomacy, I think you might be stretching the truth a little bit there.
Relatively speaking.
Okay, fair enough. You know, my lens has never changed through my entire career, and the lens I look at things through. I look at, you know, my upbringing specifically with my father and my grandfather, my mom's dad, Angelo. And it was, you do the right things for the right reason, okay, regardless of who the person is, right? You do the right thing. And when I started my career in Calexico, and we all have these stories that we can draw from, when you either were briefed on something or you had a memo, you had to do something, you would say, hey, why the hell are they making us do it this way? Don't they know? And I always looked at that, and every decision I made, every calculus towards me, you know, formulating a plan, came from that lens, I used to joke, lane 8 in Calexico, right? Where vividly, I have a vivid memory. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but coming around, the supervisor coming around and handing you this memo to read and to, okay, we're going to do this now. And that was the thing that stuck in my mind. It's like they don't know, they're disconnected, right? And then later on, as I got through my career, it's some of it was the disconnection, but a lot of it is exactly what you said, right? People didn't have the courage, the wisdom, the bravery, the stupidity, whatever it is, to say, hey, that's not going to work, or there's a better way to do it, or did you consider this? Did you consider this, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth order consequence versus, you know, this one matter? And it always stuck in my mind. And that time when I was in, I told you in Boston was a tumultuous time, and you know that better than any of us. We were in class together, and I used to talk to you to help me work through some of the things. I learned then very, very clearly that friendships aside, you have to look at the situation the way it is, regardless of who's involved. What's the right thing to do? What are the right reasons to do it? And it became evident to me at that level that if I did that, yeah, there were going to be people that weren't going to like it, right? But the bottom line is, it was the right thing to do for the right reason. Sometimes it was wrong. Sometimes I had all great intentions, and I fell flat on my face. But when you did that, people at least understood, because you told them why you were doing it. They knew it wasn't because Eric and I are buddies. It's like, no, here's the mission. Here's what we're doing. Whatever it is, big, small, little, doesn't matter. So I just kind of continue that. I mean, I have a, you know, some might say a big personality sometimes with the way I come across, but that's who I am. I'm not going to be an Eric Moncayo, who is deliberate thinker, who's specific. And I joke, I said this to you, you were like E.F. Hutton. When E.F. Hutton spoke, the old commercial, I'm dating myself, people listen. When you spoke, people listened. Right. So that was you, genuinely you. Me, I'm going to say what I think, but with a plan. And as I got further in my career, it was my responsibility to do that. And that, I think, answers some of your question. those on our positions, we rent, we lease those positions. We have a responsibility for everybody who we work with. It sounds a little corny, but the nation. So when I heard something that was very myopic in viewpoint, very singular in viewpoint, and not really taking into account what the repercussions are going to be, what it's going to do to that officer who she's standing in lane 8, how in Calexico, how is she going to react to this? Does this make sense? That's why I went there. And, you know, and with operations, that was easy. The social injustice piece was difficult. And you know this because you witnessed this, where they became battles because we as an organization could not admit that we had a problem, right? And that was outrageous to me, that we are a reflection of society. CBP is a reflection of society. 62,000 people. We don't drop us in from Mars. We don't come out of a factory. We are a product of where we grew up. We are a product of where we live. We are a product of our friends, our faith, our neighborhoods. That's who we are. And to say that in 62,000 people, we don't have any problems, you're fooling yourself. You're kidding yourself. And why I was even more boisterous there, and again, you were there, was because you and I were at the tail end of our career. The majority of the workforce in CBP, I think, is under 35 years of age. They're just starting their career. They didn't come up the same way you and I did. They came up the way they came up. That's them, right? We should not have them change to the way we view things. The organization needs to adapt to more the way they look things, right? Not, and I'm not saying one or the other, but move the needle that way. When you go to an academy class, and I'll speak for OFO, my basic academy class looked one way back in 1989. The academy classes now are made up of people that were not in my class. There are people in the classes now that were never considered a career 30 years ago in customs. And now you go in there, you got people from all over the country, all levels of education, all levels of background, all different kinds of people. Those are the people that we needed to, I felt that I needed to speak for, because of the 62,000, there's only 6, 7, 8 people in that room that will ultimately make the decision. I mean, the decision comes down to just a couple of people, but they don't have a voice in that room. I felt I needed to be the voice when I thought something was wrong or could have been done better or it was too narrow. So that's kind of why. And I never really cared. I never felt I was the smartest person in the room. I never did, right? I always looked at things from a pragmatic standpoint, practical standpoint. But I also was very comfortable in who I am and who I was then. So I had no problem speaking up, because the consequences be damned. Because if you want to take me out because I stood up or said something because I believed it was the right thing for the right reasons, thanks for the memories. I appreciate it. Take me out. And that's the way I felt.
You know what? That's wonderful explanation. I really do. I'm really glad you brought all that out. I really do think that for those that are on the front end of their careers, and looking at, you know, where they're going to end up, I think that's something that if nothing else, you know, try to figure out your personal core values, your personal, you know, compass, and then try to stick to it. And you're gonna be challenged along the way, and you're gonna have to adjust. And I'll be the first one to tell you that, you know, how I believed and what I thought when I was 20 and when I was 40 and now. I mean that's covered, you know, a range. But I think that I got to a point at, you know, early in my career where I saw things that were being done that were being done wrong, or for the wrong reasons, or with wrong intentions, and I didn't always stand up for what I thought was being wrong, and that would eat it. And so I would see that, and I'm like, you know what? I see that the consequences of these decisions. Yes. And sometimes it's just, you know, inefficiency. Other times it's, you know, you're breaking someone's heart. And I learned that as a young guy before I even joined the organization, seeing some things, you know, in the private sector. And then as I took those lessons with me throughout my career, the more comfortable I got in my own skin, and the more comfortable I got with not being afraid of challenging, you know, the institution in a polite way, in a diplomatic way, in a constructive way, I felt the need that I needed to do that for the same reasons. And then with all the social injustice issues that we were having to deal with in 2019 and 2020, you know, interwoven with the pandemic, it really forced me to adapt to that reality that I had not been confronted with in many years. And we had a lot of very, very tough conversations in that building with our staffs. And I felt that our leadership needed to know that. You know, they didn't have the thermometers that we had, where you can do those temperature checks in deep into the organization. And I felt that it was important that in that room where you have 6 to 8 people representing 60,000, that they needed to know that what you see on the label isn't always, you know, a representation of the entire product. And so I was always very grateful for you to be able to be the one to at least, you know, break away from the pack and allow some of us younger ones to be able to call a following behind you and say, you know, I agree with those sentiments because, and I could rattle off a few examples of things that I had witnessed or things I was privy to. And so we could spend several hours talking about the various things that you've already talked about. But I do want to at least hit one thing before we wrap. So you're with CT Strategies now, and I remember that same individuals that you mentioned earlier, you know, the Rick DiNucci's, Robert Bettis's, and Al Gina's of the world. I was very close into that mentorship tree as well. So I was very happy to join CT when after I retired, even happier when you joined CT. Is there anything cool and exciting that you're doing with CT that you can share with us?
Yeah, and before I do, I do want to say really quickly, I mean, you know, Al Gina certainly was a pivotal figure in my career, in my life, and continue to be even after. And I think coming to work with CT Strategies was easy because of him and Andrew, because I did have an opportunity to work with Andrew as well. And you know, they are, you talk about truth to power, you talk about being genuine, you know, you talk about being honest with oneself and with others. They epitomize that, right? Now, whether you agree with me on what I believe in is a separate issue, but that there's room and there's space to talk, and there are a lot of people that are closed off. You're either with me or you're against me. And what attracted, I know, both of us is the culture of CT Strategies, where, yeah, you can, you know, speak your mind, you can bring ideas, you can have a contrarian view on something, and it's okay, right? It's encouraged, as a matter of fact, like to be honest. So, you know, one of the things that I just had an opportunity to do with CT Strategies, go to Vietnam and do something that I really, really enjoyed and liked doing previously, but now given the opportunity by Al and Andrew, is to go and work with the Vietnamese customs and do some leadership training. Not unlike us in CBP or formerly in CBP, they deal with the same things we do: crisis management, leading change, and all those things. And it was really a great opportunity to go out there for 5 days, 4 days, and work with their equivalents of DFO sector chiefs kind of level folks. And once the facade came down, they realized that we were customs, they were customs. And then it was okay, like always happens when you get customs people in the room, they start talking customs shop, right? Like all of us. And they realized that their problems weren't any different than some of the problems we had. And so we shared some solutions. So that was very exciting. I mean, I know that CT Strategies is expanding into Vietnam, and it really is a country that I think there's a lot of growth and opportunity for really making some inroads with securing the supply chain, opportunities for growth, and really working with their government, some of the lessons learned that we had over the years to help them learn and maybe be a little more efficient. So that's something that, you know, I've been really grateful to have that opportunity and finished up, and hopefully there'll be more work to do in Vietnam, because I know that CT Strategies is focusing on that nation.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we've had a lot of conversations with the team about the growth potential and the opportunities over there. And you know, I'm excited for it. Obviously excited that you're on the team. And I think it's something that it's important that our viewers and our listeners take away is not only what you've done over the last 30 some odd years of your career, you know, challenging yourself to get better, challenging yourself to learn a better way, then subsequently challenging your leadership, challenging your staffs, challenging your team, your teams. But then after all that is said and done, I mean, I think I wrote down four different times where you said you were going to retire and it didn't work out that way. So the fact that you were just basically willing to give back, you know, give back to the organization, and now give back to a partner organization, I think is remarkable. I literally could spend another 3 hours talking to you about all sorts of things, you know, that you've touched on during our call. But I want to save that for maybe a follow-up session if we can get you on the calendar again. I know you're a busy man, even now in your quasi-retirement. And I think that's the best we're going to get out of it for the time being. But Bill, I really do appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. It's been a pleasure for me. I knew this was going to be a good conversation. I really hope our listeners have appreciated it. And again, I think we're scratching the tip of the iceberg on a lot of what we talked about today, because there's so much there that we can get to in a future call. So I don't know if you have any closing words, but I really do thank you for your time you took with us.
I want to thank you. And, you know, I do want to thank all of the people that I've worked with over the years, right? Because I've been, you know, truly, and I don't use this word often, but I've been blessed. I grew up in a place that really could never have imagined doing and seeing the things that I did. And it was because of others, right? And whether it was my family or coworkers or friends, and, you know, and I consider you in that group, because meeting you, talking to you, we came from very different backgrounds. We had certain things that united us, but it was always a pleasure to speak with you. And oftentimes we would talk to each other when, hey, Eric, I got a little bit of a problem. What do you think? Right. And you were always there. And I think that really sums up what the best of CVP is, and certainly what CT Strategies is as well. It's really, really that helping out the person next to you for no personal gain. Sometimes you just help out because it's the right thing to do. And that's really, really great to be surrounded. But thank you for your time here and your patience listening to me drone on about stories. And you know, that's problematic. But thank you. And best of luck to you and the family. And we'll talk soon.
You got it. Thanks again, Bill.
Thank you for listening to this segment of CTS Unpacked. For more information about CT Strategies and our team members, visit our website at ctstrategies.com. Connect with us on LinkedIn to share your thoughts or any ideas you'd like to see in future segments. Stay in the loop by joining our newsletter, where we share the latest CTS updates. Until next time, this is CTS Unpacked.